This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, Congressman George Miller says riders to budget bills are being used to gut our environmental laws. But there is some good news. Calerpa taxifolia. It's a seaweed that's spreading in the Mediterranean, having been dumped from an aquarium in Monaco. It's causing ecological havoc. We meet Franz Lanting, often called the world's premier nature photographer. He tells us how he uses his camera to get beneath the fur and the feathers. And in the Earth calendar, we fish for sharp-toothed muskellunge in the Niagara River. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Congress has sent to President Clinton an appropriations bill for the Department of the Interior. It includes money for key land acquisition, as well as numerous riders which many feel hamstring the government's ability to manage our natural resources. George Miller is congressman from the 7th District in California and the ranking Democrat on the Resources Committee in the House. When the Democrats were in the majority, he was the chairman. He comments on the Interior Appropriations Bill.
It is a bill that's filled with mischief. It's a bill that unfortunately has a lot of good things in it for individual members and important things for the environment and for the National Endowment for the Arts. But then, having done that, it seems that the committee, especially the Senate members, are incapable of keeping their hands off the bill, and they start adding anti-environmental riders. The two big items in the bill on the environment are the acquisition of the Headwaters Forest areas in Northern California, the old growth redwood forest that we've been trying to save for a number of years. This provides for the acquisition of about 7,500 acres. And then the canceling of the New World Mine lease in Montana, the mine that was located on, above the Clarks Fork River, above Yellowstone National Park, buying out that lease so that that mining project will not go forward. And why those are two very important things to have happen. But then we see that to get those things done, the bill gives away $10 million to Humboldt County in Northern California with no criteria on how that money will be spent. And then the state of Montana not only provides for $12 million in unmarked highway monies, but then conceivably turns over some of the environmental groups have suggested may be as much as $4 billion in federal coal reserves to the state of Montana, and that's just an absolutely unacceptable giveaway of public resources. And then once again, of course, the bill gets heavily involved in the micromanaging and really overmanaging of the forest programs in this country, where various senators have tried to keep the Forest Service from managing our resources in a more environmentally sound in sound fashion.
Miller is particularly concerned about provisions in the bill which he says reverse programs which were designed to balance recreation and wildlife interests with timber interests in the management of our national forests.
It prevents the Forest Service from issuing the new five-year plan, which really is an effort to get them to stress the diversity of the forest, including, you know, recreation, wildlife, and protecting the biological diversity of the forest, rather than just looking at the forest as a place to harvest logs. But again, a number of the Western senators, on behalf of the timber industries, have tried to block that effort. And that's one of the riders that's in the bill.
Miller is also concerned about a rider that would make it easier to export logs rather than requiring timber to be milled in the United States, a process which provides jobs in timber-dependent communities. Other matters of concern are riders which prevent reintroduction of grizzly bears in the Bitterroot ecosystem in Idaho and Montana, and limit reforms of the federal grazing program which Interior Secretary Babbitt has put in place. From Miller's perspective, the process of attaching riders on Interior Appropriations Bill is a continuation of the movement to make major changes in our environmental laws that began in the previous Congress, but stalled in the face of public outcry and opposition from a coalition of Democrats and moderate Republicans.
This is sort of like what the new Republican Congress tried when it first came, when it first took over the Congress 2 years ago. The difference here is, I think, is those people who have environmental writers, anti-environmental writers, I guess would be the correct word, have learned to be a little bit more subtle, and so it's more difficult to dig them out of the bill, and it's certainly very difficult then to go and organize the opposition to them, because they're not as brazen as they were before, but the end result is essentially the same. And so we now see in the mining area, in the timber area, in the grazing area, we see where the special interests have gone to individual senators and gotten these riders attached to this bill with no public input, with no discussion by the public, very little notice to the administration, and then the Congress is forced to vote on it. We got a fairly healthy vote against the bill in the House of Representatives, but it's not enough to defeat it.
That was Democratic Congressman George Miller from California. He was speaking about his views of the recent appropriations bill for the Department of the Interior and the legislative process that produced it. Seaweed, a natural part of aquatic ecosystems, serves a variety of purposes for marine life. But one particular species is gaining a lot of attention. Caulerpa taxifolia is spreading like wildfire in the Mediterranean Sea, and scientists have few clues as to how to stop it. The seaweed is strangling other plant life and devastating ecosystems. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on an American scientist who is trying to help researchers in Europe deal with the weed.
While few Americans have probably heard of Caulerpa taxifolia, it is becoming the topic of many conversations in Europe. Its spread is headlining many newspapers as researchers try to find a way to stop its spread. The seaweed was first discovered in the Mediterranean Sea in 1989, covering about half an acre of seafloor.
And now, just in 1997, it's already spread to as far east as Croatia and as far west as Spain and Mallorca and as far south as the island of Elba and also some coastal regions in Italy. So it's gone hundreds and hundreds of miles in this less than 10 years.
That's Dr. Larry Little, professor of marine biology at Southampton College of Long Island University. He recently returned from Nice, France, where he spent 6 months helping scientists there to better understand the weed. Dr. Little says Caulerpa, a native of the Pacific Ocean, is believed to have been introduced to Mediterranean waters by an aquarium in Monaco. The seaweed apparently found its way into the Mediterranean from runoff from the Oceanographic Center. Dr. Little says certain characteristics are enabling Caulerpa plants to thrive in this area.
It has what one might call a weed physiology. That is, it grows very, very rapidly, and it grows it's very hardy and bountiful, as we might say. And so that in this introduced environment, this particular form of it is very, very happy and can outcompete other organisms. Then the other aspect of it is that it doesn't have natural predators because it is an introduced species.
French scientists have been considering introducing a certain snail species into the Mediterranean to help slow the growth of Caulerpa. But Dr. Little says the seaweed is probably too widespread for the natural predator to have an impact. Moreover, many governments have moratoriums which prohibit the introduction of foreign species because such introductions can prove more harmful. Little is hoping research into Caulerpa's genetic makeup will help scientists combat the plant. Researchers are looking at other seaweed varieties for some clues.
The nuclei in this Caulerpa are extremely small, and so the usual chromosome counting techniques cannot be used. And so we applied a very special technique to try to identify and count chromosomes, and we managed to perfect this technique so that it can be done. And so we've started looking at different populations of the species.
Dr. Little says comparing Caulerpa taxifolia to other seaweed populations helps scientists to better understand the plant, which he says is destroying ecosystems in the Mediterranean Sea. Caulerpa is killing seagrass and Caulerpa prolifera, another type of sea plant. But slowing the growth of the seaweed is not going to be easy. Dr. Little says he doesn't believe the situation will ever get better.
It doesn't seem to have die-off regions. What we observed just in going diving in areas where it was proliferous is that it just keeps growing. It does seem to have regions where it won't invade as easily because of currents and maybe distributing in a different direction. Part of its distribution is caused presumably by fragmentation, which is enhanced by people anchoring in these areas and breaking off the organism, and then the organism floats over and establishes itself somewhere else.
Dr. Little says brochures are being distributed to boaters in hopes of increasing awareness of the Caulerpa problem and to encourage people to report sites where the seaweed is spreading. He says divers are continuing to map the spread of Caulerpa, but other than a few international meetings on the problem, Dr. Little says governments aren't doing enough to stop the spread. He says people don't realize how introductions of foreign species can adversely affect environments. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
It's The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berlin. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE. How do you think Congress is managing the environment? Give us a call and let us know. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berlin. Franz Lanting, considered among many to be the premier nature photographer in the world today, has compiled some of his most stunning photographs in his new book, Eye to Eye, Intimate Encounters with the Animal World. The book is filled with bright, colorful photographs of animals from across the globe. I recently spoke with Lanting about his latest work. Well, Mr. Lanting, you have recently published an incredible book, Eye to Eye, Intimate Encounters with the Animal World. And one of the things I noticed is that you said that you seek to get past the feathers and fur and get under the skin.
Indeed. It's a bit of a metaphor, but it goes to the core of what I'm trying to do. There's a lot of superficial beauty in nature photography, and I try to get a little bit beyond that, because there are a lot of other aspects to the natural world which I think are at least as interesting as sunrises and sunsets.
So how does a photographer do that?
Well, I do tend to spend a lot of time with my subjects. I try to gain the trust of the subjects I work with, and most animals in the wild tend to be rather shy, and I try to give them the opportunity to get used to me and give them the chance to either get closer or back off, and it becomes a bit more of an interactive process that way. It's not as simple as just planting your camera on a tripod and looking at the animals through a long lens.
And the second section of your book, which features animals in pairs or in social relationships,
Were those particularly difficult to photograph? It seems hard to me to make sure you get them together and interacting in a way that you can capture them on the camera.
Yeah, on one level, of course, photographing behavior in its intimate details is quite a challenge because it doesn't happen very often that it is so clear that it can be conveyed in a single photograph. But on the other hand, it's perhaps a little easier than these other portraits. Whenever there's a one-on-one contact, of course, I'm very exposed. And when animals get focused on each other, then I'm more like a passive observer. And in the second section of the book, as you mentioned, animals are photographed as pairs. You know, throughout the book, I've tried to get an idea across that most animals are organized along the same universal principles.
And what would you like the person, what is the image, what are some of the images that you would like the reader of this beautiful book to take away with them? If there are one or two or three images, what are the most significant from your perspective?
It's an image of a pair of emperor penguins interacting with their offspring, a chick, on the frozen sea ice off Antarctica. And it is such an archetypal image, one that conveys a sense of caring and equal sharing in the chores that go into raising children, that people just could not get enough of it. So that is certainly one. There's another image in the book that is almost the opposite. It's a lion at twilight, hiding in tall grass. And of course, lions don't want to get seen at all. They'd rather be invisible so they can stalk their prey. And by choosing a particular vantage point and waiting until twilight and then bringing in some experimenting lighting techniques, it really gets that idea of a cross, of a big predator lurking out there in the grass.
As someone who has been watching wildlife now for at least a couple of decades and thinking about the tremendous toll that our civilization has wrought on our biodiversity and wildlife, how do you feel about where we're going? Are our grandchildren going to be able to see some of these beasts that you've taken a picture of, or are we in a downward spiral?
Well, there are definitely very disturbing trends around the planet, and in the course of my own work, when I have an opportunity to go back to places, often I am not very hopeful, and yet I do not want to give in to pessimism, because at the same time I feel we've made a lot of headway. When I compare with the way children are educated these days about the environment and the sanctity of other lives besides, say, the human species, I'm hopeful. And my overriding mission is to try and contribute to that process of awareness building. In this book, there are no immediate references to environmental degradation, but I definitely do pay attention to those things in the course of other projects. Much of my work when I go out into the field is definitely framed within a human context. I try to show the relations, whether they be antagonistic or whether they are positive, between people and their own environments. And I've done that, for instance, in places like Madagascar, which is a unique island off the coast of Africa. I've done it in the Okavango Delta in the country of Botswana. I've done it in the Amazon Basin, and I will continue to do that.
One of the things that's happened with modern technology is that everybody with a small amount of money has a camera, mm-hmm. and a lot of them spend their vacations going to parks and other places where there is wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
As a real artist with a camera and with wildlife, what advice do you have for the rank amateur who wants to take good pictures of animals while they're off on a trip someplace?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, capturing souvenirs from trips abroad is a very legitimate way to use a camera, and I do that myself. I take snapshots too, but I think any amateur photographer who is interested in doing something that is uniquely personal, I couldn't give a better recommendation than to say, try it in your own backyard. You simply can't go to Africa for 2 weeks and expect to come back with meaningful results because professionals like myself spend months, if not years, there. But everybody has a backyard. Everybody has a special personal place that is worthy of being documented and interpreted in an emotional manner. And that's how I got started myself.
That was nature photographer Frans Lanting talking about his new book, Eye to Eye, Intimate Encounters with the Animal World. It's published by Taschen. Stay with us. The Earth Calendar is next. Early to mid-November brings absolutely fantastic fishing for muskellunge, or muskies, in the Niagara River. The river connects Lake Erie and Lake Ontario and is best known for the falls which bear its name. The muskie is a fierce-looking beast. Some fishermen say it's the barracuda of the north, and others call it the fish of a thousand casts because it's famous for being difficult to hook and successfully land. While he is reluctant to talk about muskie fishing, Joe Ognabin, fishing columnist for the Niagara Gazette and retired producer of a television fishing program, doesn't need a thousand casts to pull them in at this time of year.
The best muskie fishing is in the upper Niagara, which is the stretch of river above Niagara Falls going into Lake Erie. It's not uncommon, and I get the reports from the Muskie Association, which is out of Buffalo, that they'll catch 3, 4, 5 muskies in one trip, and the smallest one would be 40 inches. We undoubtedly have one of the finest muskie fisheries in the whole country, and I'm very happy to say that more than 90% of the fellows who fish for muskies around here adhere strictly to catch and release. They're very, very careful when they get a muskie alongside the boat to not drag him in by the gills and hold him up and show him off. Most of the fellows, if they're going to measure it, they measure that fish in the water. And if they're quiet and careful, the muskie won't do a lot of thrashing around.
Ognabin says muskies are sort of second cousins to the northern pike. He says in those parts of the country, a muskie must be at least 40 inches to be kept. Most anglers don't have a problem with meeting the minimum requirements.
From the tables that I've looked at from the muskie organization, their average muskie they're catching is 46 to 48. It will be long, it'll be built like a torpedo with a long jaw and snout on him. And the mouth is absolutely filled with razor-sharp teeth that, somewhat like a shark, they bend backwards. And their coloration is a combination of brown and green, and they're an absolutely beautiful fish to see. They look malevolent. If you ever go to an aquarium where they have muskies and you look one in the eye, and he'll stare you right back, and you can almost see evil in those eyes. And they put up a battle that's just awesome, just awesome.
Ognabin says while muskies don't compare to walleye or yellow perch in terms of taste, the fight alone makes it worth trying to land one. He has often caught a muskie while bass fishing with a chrome-blue rattle trap or some other lure. The best part of living in western New York State, according to Ognabin, is the variety of fish species that is available to anglers. And for him, it's some of the best bass fishing in the country.
Plus, we have a number of small streams that empty into Lake Ontario that in the fall of the year are loaded with bass, or with chinook, coho, brown trout, and rainbows. So a fellow has a real problem, you know, you might say, as to what is he going to fish for today? Is he going to fish for salmon? That means he's going to have a heavier rod. You're going to fish for trout with a fly rod and take a chance on hanging a rampaging chinook? Well, I'll tell you, this is really, really a problem.
Undoubtedly, this is a problem that many frustrated anglers would welcome. So if muskie fishing sounds exciting to you, you still have a couple of weeks before lake effect snows bury the shores of Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. you can just shuffle off to Buffalo and head north of Niagara Falls. But whatever you do, don't tell the locals that you heard it from Joe Ognabin. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Listening to The Environment Show, I'm Peter Burley. 10 years ago, an international treaty was signed in Montreal which provides for the phase-out of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. Those are the chemicals used in refrigerators which destroy the ozone in our atmosphere that protects us from solar radiation. The United States and European countries have given up CFCs, but developing countries were given more time to get rid of the chemicals. We look at how the process is going. We talk green about wetlands. We're still losing 117,000 acres a year, but many groups who don't like wetland regulations have formed a lobby to change the Clean Water Act and relax the rules. It's called the National Wetlands Coalition. And author Howard Frank Mosier presents a portrait of his special place along the riverfront between Lake Superior and Lake Huron at Sault Ste. Marie, where the bass, pickerel, and trout give the fisher a fight, but it's the salmon that makes your line smoke. As the world prepares for the Conference on Global Warming to be held in Kyoto next month, we've discussed what could be done to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by reducing consumption of fossil fuels. Sometimes the challenge seems hopeless. But international agreements to reduce the release of harmful gases to the atmosphere have been negotiated in the past and have achieved results. In our continuing series on climate change in the atmosphere, we recall that this year marks the 10th anniversary of the signing of the Montreal Protocol, which provided for the phase-out of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, which destroy the Earth's atmosphere. Not long ago, a meeting was held in Zurich to address the particular problems of phasing out CFCs in developing countries. For the most part, the industrialized world is out of CFCs, but developing countries with warm climates like India are demanding more refrigeration and more air conditioning as standards of living improve. This generates tremendous demand for CFCs, since the Montreal Protocol gave the developing countries more time to phase out the ozone-depleting chemical. Fortunately, there's technology which can make CFCs unnecessary. From Swiss Radio International, Bob Zantoni reports.
The Montreal Protocol for the Protection of the Ozone Layer came into force in 1987, following the discovery of the ozone hole over Antarctica. The major cause of atmospheric ozone depletion was known to be chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs for short. They had been used as propellants in aerosols, but were also in widespread use as coolants in refrigerators and freezers. While industrialized countries have now discontinued using CFCs, the underdeveloped world was given more time to reduce their CFC usage. By 2005, this should be down by 50% at least. The specific focus of the Zurich meeting was progress in phasing out CFCs in the refrigeration equipment sold in underdeveloped countries. One of the conference's Swiss organizers, Otmar Schwank, explains why it's such an important issue.
something in the order of 30 to 50% of the consumption of CFC can be overall attributed to refrigeration. From all the CFCs which have caused the ozone hole, the consumption of the North has caused the large chunk of it. But the North has now converted and is no longer a major emitter, while the consumption of these fluids in the South is still growing. And if we want to achieve healing of the ozone hole, we have to manage to bring the consumption down in the South also to really benefit of getting the ozone layer restored.
There is no shortage of viable alternatives to CFCs in refrigeration systems, but the problem has been to develop simple, easy maintenance refrigeration equipment appropriate to the needs of the underdeveloped world. The challenge has been taken up by several affected countries, including India. Scientists at the National Chemical Laboratory in Pune have been successful in designing prototypes of a new generation of CFC-free refrigerators. Dr. Sukumar Duvota is the head of the laboratory's engineering services.
We have been running with non-CFCs for nearly 18 months or so. We have refrigerators working with hydrocarbons, isobutane, hydrocarbon blends. Hydrocarbons are zero ozone depleting, that is fully ozone compatible. Two, they have very negligible global warming effect.
When do you imagine production could start?
Yeah, it's a question of just getting the prototypes made and market trials, etc. So by another 3 years' time, I think many non-CFC brands in India will be available.
Most of the lesser developed countries are in tropical or subtropical parts of the world. But as industrialization and affluence rise, so does the number of previous luxuries, such as refrigerators and air conditioners. Environmental and development assistance agencies agree that this is legitimate. The real concern is to convince the average consumer that, number one, there is a problem, and number two, to be willing to spend the money on a new fridge or air conditioner. Adli Nada Ahmad is with the Arab Office for Youth and Environment based in Egypt.
If you came to Egypt 20 years ago, you would find that a very small percentage of people, very, very small, are using air conditioning. Now, air conditioning is becoming one of the very normal things, especially in urban areas. So the situation is getting worse than we were imagining like 10 years ago when we were discussing the Montreal Protocol. And this is why Egypt was very much aware to start looking at the alternatives from now. So Egypt has one of the very advanced and very progressed programs dealing with the ozone issue.
The government may be sensitive to this issue. You may have a lot of official support. But what about the people? They've saved a lot of money. This is a hardship to buy many of these luxuries. They cost a lot of money. And now you come to them and say, these are environmentally unfriendly. We have to switch them. Don't they sort of look at you and say, you're crazy? No way.
First thing that they think about is, you know, money. And, you know, they look at the whole thing from the financial point of view. We try to find a program that will make, you know, this transition without getting, you know, the consumers, the people themselves negatively affected by the process. So we want to establish programs to train them, to make a sort of public awareness, and also to help the small enterprises, the workshops, the informal sector, to be able to deal with the new technology.
Adli Nada Ahmad, one of the participants at the Zurich conference to review the Montreal Protocol and its implementation in underdeveloped countries.
That was Bob Zantoni of Swiss Radio International reporting. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Berlich. Joining me in the studio is journalist Susan Arbetter, and today we're talking about the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act declared that it would make our waters fishable and swimmable. And the big question is, after 25 years, how are we doing? Now, there are a couple of aspects of the Clean Water Act. One provided for the building of sewage treatment plants and basically dealing with pollution that comes out of pipes. Another piece of it regulates wetlands. Wetlands are swamps, important for the nation's water supply and its purity because wetlands clean water. And what the Clean Water Act says is that many wetlands cannot be filled. That means putting dirt in them, unless you get a permit from the Corps of Engineers. Just by way of background, you should know that about 117,000 acres of wetlands are still being lost each year in the United States, and our current wetland inventory, if you like, is about half of what it was when the European settlers arrived on the continent. So we have two experts with us who have quite differing views on this subject. One is Drew Caputo, and he's a lawyer for the environmental group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he's based in Washington, D.C. Also with us is Bob Szabo, and he's executive director and counsel of the National Wetlands Coalition. Now, the National Wetlands Coalition is an organization which represents what it calls the regulated community, and by and large, these are folk who have argued that existing regulations are either too strict or impractical or not workable.
Peter, why don't we start with Drew Caputo. Drew, how are you today?
I'm great, Susan. How are you?
Good. Drew's with the NRDC. How was the Clean Water Act supposed to protect wetlands areas? And do you think that the Clean Water Act is doing the job that it was intended to do?
Well, I think we're doing a better job of protecting wetlands today than we were 25 years ago. And one way to measure that is, as Peter just mentioned, several weeks ago, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued their latest report about the annual rate of wetlands loss. And the annual net loss in the country is now about 120,000 acres a year.
Yeah, Peter was mentioning. Uh-huh.
Now, that's both good news and bad news. It's good news in the sense that the rate of loss has dropped fairly dramatically from where it was certainly 25 years ago and even from where it was 10 or 15 years ago. That's the good news. The bad news is that we're now today almost a decade after President George Bush committed the nation to no net loss of wetlands. And almost a decade later, we're still 120,000 acres in the hole. To me, what that means is that we need to do a better job of protecting wetlands than we do right now.
Now, Bob, my understanding is that your organization has felt that we simply have controls that are too onerous and don't work very well.
Yeah, you made a couple of statements in your introductory remarks that I would like to return to. When the Clean Water Act passed in 1977, it wasn't at all clear that Section 404 was about wetlands. In fact, it doesn't even use the term wetlands. It requires a permit for the discharge of dredged and fill material into navigable waterways. And it is court decisions and things that have turned that into a wetlands regulatory program. And so it's a program that has not as much been designed by Congress as it has evolved through court decisions and agency actions.
Well, I'm sure our listeners are not totally fascinated by the legal side of this, but let me ask you something.
Well, let me tell you why that's important, because all these statistics you're throwing out are based on, there's one major fallacy that underscores everything, and that is that there's no definition of what a wetland is. They are swamps, which you have mentioned, and we all agree that swamps are wetlands, and this debate is not about swamps. But there are a lot of things that look like dry land to people, particularly when they own them, that the government considers to be wetlands, and that's what this debate is about.
Well, Drew, would you happen to agree with Bob? Do we not know specifically what a wetlands is?
No, I think scientists have a pretty clear understanding of what wetlands are. The development industry, which has been attacking the Clean Water Act's wetlands protections for the better part of the last decade, has been carrying forth this argument that wetland definitions are arbitrary or somehow unscientific for the better part of the last decade. And in 1995, triggered by that debate, the National Academy of Sciences issued a very detailed report about wetlands definition issues. And the conclusion of that report was that the current scientific definition used under the Clean Water Act for identifying and protecting wetlands is perfectly sound as a matter of science. So there's no basis for attacking it as being unscientific.
Well, Bob, let's understand that there are differing views, but there is now the manual and subject to interpretation, but there it is. Do you take the view that whatever the definition is, that there should be less protection for these areas, or simply a different kind?
I think the view we take is this, that today the law regulates all wetlands, no matter how valuable or marginal they might be, with the same level of strenuousness. That would not be a problem, except that three-quarters of these lands are owned by private property owners. We take the position that once you've decided what a wetland is, you should regulate the valuable wetlands more strenuously than you regulate the less valuable wetlands, and some judgment should be used in how strenuously you regulate these properties.
And who decides which is a valuable wetland and which is not, Bob?
Well, today that's a split decision between the Corps of Engineers and the EPA. We have always been for one agency making that judgment. We nominate the Corps because there are more of them out in the field. The environmental community doesn't want the Corps to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We really, frankly, don't care who does it, but just one agency should do it.
Right. Drew, you know, it does sound like Bob has a point that there's an overabundance of regulation going on here.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear that I don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
The law is that you need a permit in order to fill a wetland, but permits are granted almost as easily as one can get water when one turns on a tap. This is a process in which the vast majority, much better than 90% of the wetlands permits, are granted. Now, it's a sensitive area because in some circumstances, more rare than we like, applications for wetlands permits are actually denied. But I think it's hard to attack the system as being incredibly onerous when the overwhelming majority of permit applications are granted. Let me say one other thing about that.
Sure.
I said earlier that there was some good news about the rate of wetlands loss, and the good news was that the rate has dropped over the last 25 years. The single biggest reason why that rate has dropped is that the Clean Water Act has been doing a better job of protecting wetlands. And from my perspective, that encouraging trend ought to make us redouble our efforts to do a better job of protecting wetlands. And I think the system is pretty well set up to strike a reasonable balance between protecting the environment on the one hand and facilitating responsible economic development on the other if some more resources can be put toward the system.
So again, it seems like we're back to the same old argument, the private property versus public good. Drew, maybe you can explain to the average person on the street why we should protect our wetlands. I mean, they're kind of swampy, they have mosquitoes. Why are they so important?
Well, they do three groups of really important things. The first thing they do is they protect water quality by filtering pollutants from rivers, lakes, and coastal waters. The second thing wetlands do is provide protection against floods because they have an enormous natural ability to absorb a lot of water very quickly. So if there's a wetland located upstream of your property and there's a flood coming your way, your chances of getting flooded are going to be decreased to the extent the wetland is protected. And the final thing wetlands do is they provide incredibly valuable habitat for all sorts of species of fish and wildlife. And you can take your pick about which types of species are most important to you. If you like endangered species, for example, wetlands are really important habitat for many of those species, including well-known species like the whooping crane. If you come from a more economic angle and you're concerned about the economic base in places like the Chesapeake Bay or coastal Louisiana, where the commercial fishing and shell fishing industry is really important, wetlands serve as nursery and feeding habitat for all sorts of commercially harvested fish.
It was Bush who originally said that we should go for no net loss, i.e. we should preserve our wetlands base and we shouldn't lose any more of it. We've talked about the fact that we're still losing them. Is the no net loss idea, Bob, something that your coalition adheres to, or do you see it as flawed conceptually?
No, we adhere to no net loss. Again, it goes back to what you consider to be a wetland. The EPA administrator, when Bush made that statement, also went on to say that we ought to apply a duck test to this land. If a duck could land in it and swim in it, that's what we ought to be regulating. So
you would adhere to no net loss, but you do not adhere to what the existing definition is.
We think the existing definition is too broad.
So
but
if
we're not
one
gonna,
uses the existing
but
definition,
if, but
how much loss do we take?
If you can let me finish, we're not going to win that argument. We're not going to change the definition. We do embrace no net loss. We think that you can get to no net loss by doing two things. Varying your strenuousness of regulation based on the value of the wetland involved, and promoting mitigation banking, which is a way that we can return hundreds of acres of wetlands back into the system. And those are the two ways we think you can achieve not only no net loss, which was part of the president's stated goal, but the second part of it was a net gain of wetlands. And if you noticed over the weekend, Mr. Gore announced that they were going to try to achieve a program that would gain 100,000 acres of wetlands. I guess that was annually.
All right, Bob. Well, we're going to start to wrap things up here. Besides a different definition of what is a wetland, what do you think needs to be done? How should we change public policy surrounding this issue?
Well, I think you ought to focus this program into the hands of one agency. And again, we're value neutral as to who you pick, but it ought to be in the hands of one person. It'd be awfully convenient if someday you can give people a little bit of indication before they buy a property whether it's a wetland or not. A lot of people have bought property thinking it was not a wetland, only to find it is a wetland, and then they're stuck. Mm. We think that you should vary the strenuousness of regulation based on whether this is a very valuable or a marginal wetland. We believe in mitigation and making up and restoring wetlands when you disturb a wetland. Those are the kind of things we think need to be put
okay, place. And Drew, where do you come out?
Well, I think the development community has different changes they'd like to see in the law, and I put them in two categories. There are things like changing the definition of wetlands to the duck test and adding a whole bunch of new exemptions for different industries, which is legislation that Mr. Szabo has been pushing for years. And that those are proposals that aren't going to get anywhere. They're bad policy, and almost all of them are based on bad science. But there's a second category of things that I think we can actually make common ground between environmentalists and developers. I think, for example, as Mr. Szabo said, if we could put together some programs that do a better job of giving landowners notice that they might have wetlands on their property and that they might have legal obligations as a result of those wetlands, and if we do other things like that, I think we can take several big steps down the road of increasing the predictability and accountability that landowners can expect from the Corps of Engineers when it administers the wetlands program. And to the extent we can shift the debate off the unscientific ideas like redefinition and onto these focused types of meaningful on-the-ground procedural reforms, I think we can actually make the program work better for both landowners and the environment.
I've been talking with Drew Caputo from the Natural Resources Defense Council and Bob Szabo from the National Wetlands Coalition, which represents the regulated community. With me has been my friend and co-journalist, Susan Arbetter. I'm Peter Burley. Stay with us. We're going to St. Mary's River and the Great Lakes next. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. You can reach us by email at green@wamc.org. You can listen to us anytime on your personal computer over the web, www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street, and for others, it's deep in the wilderness. Author Howard Frank Mosier presents a portrait of his special place on St. Mary's River between Lake Superior and Lake Huron. He reads from his book, North Country, A Personal Journey, published by Houghton Mifflin.
At first, the boardwalk along Sault Ste. Marie's riverfront seemed deserted that afternoon. Then I saw a lone spinning rod leaning against the railing, its thin monofilament line angling far down into the river current, where it set in close to the Canadian shore. I looked around for the fishermen and spotted two beat-up sneakers sticking out of the shrubbery a few feet away. "How's the fishing?" I called out. The sneakers shifted, there was a rustling, and a rugged young man in a painter's cap and white pants, spattered with green and yellow, emerged from the bushes, where he'd been sitting out of the wind, waiting for a bite. Bob Bagnell told me that he was a house painter by trade, and a fisherman every minute that he wasn't painting houses. Right here, within 100 yards of the border and just across the river from the busiest shipping channel in the world, he regularly caught more than a dozen species of game fish. Bob, who was in his mid-20s, told me that he'd fished the St. Mary's here below the site of the first lock built on the river almost daily, summer, fall, winter, and spring, since he was a small boy. Like Tom Sawyer, he'd sneak out of his bedroom window after the rest of the household was asleep, drop off the porch roof, and slip down to the river for a little clandestine nocturnal angling for lunker brown trout and catfish. In fact, he'd fished here so long that he could usually tell what sort of fish he had on just by the way it was biting. A pickerel hits very lightly, eh? They jab, jab, jab. A trout of any kind, he'll strike with much faster, stronger jerks. Bass, both largemouths and smallmouths, they'll run with a bait, stop, turn it in their mouth, run again. After they stop the second time, that's when you set the hook. Bottom feeders, sturgeon, catfish, whitefish, they suck in the bait and give a slow, steady pull. But when you see your rod tip bend right down hard and the line starts smoking off the reel, that's very likely a salmon. Then, mister, you've got a battle on your hands. An active conservationist, Bob frequently volunteers to assist with federal and provincial stocking and fish counting efforts in the Sioux area. Still, he was quick to point out that, like the cod on the Grand Banks off the Atlantic coast, the populations of whitefish and lake trout in the Great Lakes border waters have been so badly devastated by centuries of overfishing and pollution, not to mention the ravages of the sea lampreys, which attach themselves to the sides of game fish and suck out their lifeblood like vampires, that commercial fishing in Superior and Huron is nearly a phenomenon of the past. I myself kill very few fish these days, Bob said. Once in a great while I'll keep a salmon or a trout to give to a relative or a friend, and over the years I've kept one trophy fish of each species to have mounted. All the rest go back in the river. That's where they belong, eh? If sport fishing in the Sioux is going to have a future. Bob Bagnell and I shook hands. I wished him luck and headed up the boardwalk toward my car. When I glanced back to wave, he had faded into the shrubbery. The only trace of his presence was his black spinning rod leaning against the railing at an expectant angle, as Bob waited out of sight to come forth and battle great shimmering emerald pickerel, pike as long as your leg, trout as bright as autumn hills, dark, fierce muskellunge, prehistoric-looking sturgeon, and four kinds of salmon, which he lifts up to admire in his landing net, then releases unharmed to swim free in the St. Mary's River, where they belong.
Howard Frank Mosier is author of North Country, A Personal Journey, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berling. You can't find The Weeds in the Mediterranean without a cassette copy of the program. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 410. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for The Environment Show.